Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy Syracuse 110 football games, and Happy New Year by the time you listen to this.
Yeah, Happy New Year indeed. This has been a weird but another fun year of Syracuse athletics. Syracuse football won 10 games for the first time in 17 years. The Orange men's basketball team managed to piss everybody off again by getting an unlikely inclusion into the field and then getting all the way to the Sweet 16. Women's basketball team made the NCAA tournament again. The men's soccer team got back to the NCAA tournament. Softball team made the NCAAs for the first time in a while. The volleyball team, I think, made it for the first time ever. Men's lacrosse made it once again, as did women's lacrosse. Some disappointing finishes there, but nonetheless successful because they made the postseason. The cross-country streak ended in terms of team success, winning ACC titles, but you know, Paige Stoner, Justin Knight, and plenty of others had plenty of success this year for the Orange track and field group as well. I'm sure I'm forgetting some teams in there, but those are just the kind of like very quick hit highlights, I think, Dan.
Yeah, I'd say, like, if you weigh things a bit towards, like, how the football team did this year, since that's so, so very important, and then toss in some of these other things, like, it's got to be one of the more overall successful years we've had, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah, I mean, these last 5 years in particular have been, you know, we've had a couple national championships in there, but mostly just a high level of success across the board. And like I said, when you start seeing teams like the volleyball team being able to come up and, you know, start punching above their weight and becoming, you know, nationally relevant, like stuff like that is just, it's where you and I have talked about this before. I'll give Daryl Gross credit for understanding that, but you know, it didn't come to fruition with all those teams really becoming better and more successful and well-rounded until after he departed.
Yeah, I was going to bring up Gross too. Like, he gets a lot of pretty well-earned derision. But the advancement of like the overall athletics profile, I think, does fall pretty heavily on him. Not all of him, because it's not, like you said, it's really come to roost after he left. But before he got to SU, we were very Pitt-ish in terms of like where most of our sports were, and he definitely upped the ante for most of the non-revs. Which you know, it's not everything, but it's nice to have like a well-rounded program where you always have something to root for and some like greater kind of less, you know, it's nice to not just be dedicated to football and basketball and then like have nothing else to like represent your university, especially when you have like a guy like Justin Knight, who is an all-world, probably in the top, I mean, top five might be being conservative, like Syracuse athletes of all time.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I think this move was worked out pretty well with our move to the ACC, where, you know, now we're competing with a lot of really well-rounded athletic programs. I mean, Notre Dame, UVA, I think for the most part, like, we've been able to not surpass UVA, but as UVA picks up a lot of, you know, titles in fencing and crap like that. But I do think that, you know, where we kind of benefit over UVA is that while we compete for some of those and do win some of those, you know, quote-unquote lesser national championships, our football team has been pretty damn good now this year. The basketball team has managed to beat UVA in the NCAA tournament in recent years. We don't lose to 16 seeds. That's a thing we don't do. But yeah, I think that SU definitely timed this all right to become more of an ACC program. From a, you know, total athletic standpoint. So I'm happy about that. Hope it continues, because, you know, that's how we're going to be able to elevate the status of this athletic program, the status of this athletic department, and just the university in general. Getting, you know, a more well-rounded, I think, picture to present to prospective students that, you know, we're not just a basketball and football school. We're not just a school that focuses on a couple of revenue sports. We have, like, a rich athletic history completely down the line.
Yeah, pretty much everything. Like, we don't have a ton of sports because we are a private school. We're in upstate New York. Like, there are a lot of limiting factors, but we've been at least, like, pretty competitive in everything that we do over the last, like, 6 or 7 years, which is really cool.
Agreed, agreed. One of the most notable things that has happened in the last year, Syracuse won the Camping World Bowl. They went 10-3 this year. It was not something that anyone expected before the season started, and you can't convince me otherwise, but that's fine. I said 6-6. A lot of people said worse, and you know what? We're all happy to be wrong together. I'll very much take the 10-3 record. We'll probably finish somewhere near the top 15 or so. That's in and of itself pretty amazing. I think the schedule helped there, obviously. Not a senior heavy team, because that's not a fair characterization, but a senior team in the right spots really helped there. And also having a West Virginia team that really just didn't come to play. I think that we kind of messed around for a half, but I was happy to see us really pull away in that fourth quarter and put this game away, considering I do think we did outplay the Mountaineers for much of the evening.
Yeah, it was an interesting game, and I think it actually kind of summed up the season pretty well, where, you know, Syracuse didn't have 10 wins. I think up to the outside will probably look like, you know, a candidate for, like, serious regression, or, like, it was, you know, there were some fluky things. But honestly, like, Syracuse won 10 games without always playing its best football. You know, there were a couple games where they came out really, really strong. There were some games they kind of struggled to win, like UNC. But, like, this, I thought this was a very much a 10-win football team, and you could, like, complain about Greer being out or whatever. But Syracuse, I think, played, like, their B game, and they looked better to the top, from top to bottom, than West Virginia. And, like, I didn't think Jack Allison was horrible. He wasn't great. He wasn't very accurate, but he wasn't, like, you know, unplayable. Dungy was fine, but probably had one of his, I'd say, bottom half games this year.
Second half was lights out, though.
Yeah, his efficiency ended up being very strong. I mean, he was at 10.1 yards per attempt. He made the crazy fluke play to Mo Neal. But, like, it wasn't like a crazy Dungy, like, early season or what was it, the NC State game, where he was just unstoppable. So, like, this wasn't Syracuse just getting lucky, or Syracuse only beating West Virginia because they were missing some players. Like, Syracuse just looked like the better roster overall. And I think that was, like, kind of what we learned this year. This team just really rounded out into form at midseason, and they just really they looked the part. And next year, I mean, we saw some outside people talking yesterday, especially when there were those stupid, not even, I wouldn't even call Babers the Miami rumors. It was like
somebody mentioned it once.
Someone mentioned it, and then it was like, oh, maybe this could be a thing, even though there's no indication of that, because Miami just went with Manny Diaz, which is, you know, an interesting move. But they got it done quick. Syracuse, like, on paper, should be better next year, which is scary. And that's not just being, like, a homer. Losing Dungy's big, and there's no guarantee that Tommy DeVito steps in and is, like, a better player or even as good a player right away. But overall, we bring back, like, almost every major contributor outside of a handful and add a very promising quarterback, and then have, like, a lot of freshmen who played giant roles this year turn into sophomores and sophomores into juniors. So, like, this is a pretty attractive program, I think, for the next 2 or 3 years, like, at minimum. And obviously, you see teams bottom out really quickly in college football, but we're really well-situated for a bit here, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you spoke to kind of some of those depth, like, changes just from a perception standpoint, that a few years ago, you know, you lose two of your starting defensive linemen, And like, SU screwed, they can't generate any pressure. Instead, SU generated a ton of pressure. Kendall Coleman picked up 3 sacks, which was, I think, an underrated performance in the game. And, like, Dungy got the MVP, and I think it was well-deserved. But if it wasn't going to him, I think it should have gone to Coleman, who really played a huge role in just bum-rushing the offensive line for West Virginia. He took advantage, in particular, of the inexperience under center between Lowe and Allison. I think, you know, that people to bring up Greer and bring up Jennings, you know, as notable absences, those are all fair. But I again, and we talked about this before the game, not on the podcast, because at the time we didn't know who was going to be gone. But McKinley Williams is our second best run stopper, and Alden Robinson was our best pass rusher. So losing those two players was, you know, nothing to just ignore. Obviously, Antoine Cordy being out was also problematic. Trill Williams not playing, something else that could have been problematic. So it's not as if SU was at full strength and just completely laid waste, you know, to West Virginia's B team and doesn't deserve credit for it. I think, you know, this, like we had said before the bowls and even midseason. Like, nobody cares how you got to 10-3, just the fact that you did. And I think there are things to be a little concerned about next year. I'm not concerned about replacing Jamal Custis, not to slight Custis, but I think we just have such a depth of receiver right now. I think that offensive line and defensive line are going to be just two, not trouble areas, but two areas that might take a few games. And luckily, you know, our season shapes out schedule-wise that we can kind of take those steps to figure out who's going to be the starter and get those guys some valuable reps. I think one of the other more valuable things that happened in this game was getting Tristan Jackson and Abdul Adams in the game and seeing just how impactful they were. I thought if we saw them, it would be limited. I was stunned by how important they were and how crisp both of them looked in this offense, despite not having played in it in a game ever.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Obviously, Jackson, I think, came in a little later, but it seemed like we just kind of fully integrated them into the offense, and they didn't really take away from anyone else's stuff. It was just more guys in the rotations. Adams, obviously, had the two touchdowns. He didn't do much else, but we had some trouble with like the short yardage running for a bit there. Jackson looked really smooth, had that one really nice touchdown catch, another nice catch. I think what ended with 3 for 27.
Yeah.
So like, it's just more weapons, and the receiving core, like you said, is even without Custis. We need a guy like that to stretch a field. Maybe Jackson helps out in that regard, but like it's such a fun group. We'll miss Riley for sure because he's had so many big games for us over the last couple of years. But
well, he's got one like, more.
Oh right, he does have one more.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we are really really well stacked with Taj Harris, with Jackson, with just a litany of guys who came up big this year. Even like a guy like Sherrod Johnson who I feel like didn't play much earlier in the year and has had some nice games down the stretch. Like, guys have just gotten the chance to prove themselves and have kind of come in and out, and we've done a really nice job of integrating everyone. It feels like even when it's just with 2 weeks left and you're like, all right, well, now we have these two transfers who can play. I thought Babers did a nice job of, like, seeing what they could do without, like, having them disrupt the offense in any way. It seemed pretty seamless putting them in.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I thought he was doing a little gamesmanship and being a little coy early on. When he was talking about, you know, not necessarily incorporating them and I think he did pay deference to the guys that had been there, but at the same time, like, you know, you mentioned in the short yarded stuff, like, it's not like Syracuse was running all that well close to the goal line. Giving it to somebody new who they didn't necessarily have a scouting report on, I thought was fine. Like, Adams ran, you know, in some of those spots like a man on fire, and that was the sort of thing that, like, we saw from Jarvion Howard here and there, but we have struggled with. So having Adams, like, I think Adams is going to end up probably evenly splitting carries with Neal as the starter for the most part. And Neal had an impressive game in and of itself. But, like, I think Adams does fill a role we didn't necessarily have filled before. I also loved what we saw from Aaron Hackett. Second half in general, just saw, like, some real, like, breakout performances from a bunch of guys that we hadn't seen much of in the first half. Custis and Harris were the only guys that caught passes in the first half. So to see that list grow quite a bit in the second, I think was part of, you know, why Dungy had much more success throwing the ball. It was 14-16 in the second half, which, I mean, he's not someone known necessarily for his accuracy, and I felt like he just made such better decisions over the final 30 minutes. But yeah, I think you're not going to see a ton of tight end usage, but Hackett, like, was, I know a couple people tweeted this out that, you know, Hackett made a couple of, like, you know, Mark Bavaro type plays and just was an absolute bruiser on that one catch up the seam that was really big towards, you know, extending that drive and helping SU get a score out of it. So I think I'm really, like you said, I'm really excited to see a lot of these guys. I'm curious what happens with the wide receiver position over the next couple of years, because I do feel like we're starting to develop a little bit of a backlog. I mean, there's guys like Cameron Jordan who've yet to see the field, RTB, you know, Ed Hendricks comes back from injury, Cooper Lutz. There's so many players that have, like, yet to even see the field. So we could really have, like, we're not going to run 8 wide receivers out there, obviously, but we do have the depth to deal with some injuries and really, you know, mix up the looks and confuse a hell of a lot of defenses. So I'm very optimistic there. I'm optimistic about the defense too. Tywell Richards, I mentioned this in the post that I wrote last week, just about you know, kind of providing a 2019 preview. But like seeing guys like Kingsley Jonathan step up in the game, Andre Sisco obviously stepped up just as he had all year, led the team in tackles with 9. Richards has been able to get a couple opportunities late in this season and made the most of them. 6 tackles in this game with a sack. And then that clutch interception from Alan Pritzinger, the guy who was injured his senior year of high school, came in as a running back, switched over to defensive back. You and I even said in the preseason we weren't sure how long that was going to stick. Obviously stuck just fine. Ends up that that he got that pick, and you know that's kind of the benefit of switching an offensive player over to defense, is that they're probably going to have better hands. They might not be as good of a coverage guy, but you know he was the beneficiary of a nice tip. So plenty of other guys in there that had a real impact, but those are just some of the names that I at least wanted to highlight. You know, just both recapping this game and going into next year.
Yeah, it was really it was cool to see Stritzinger out there even earlier in the game. It was a little blaring to see him because you're not used to seeing him out there in big spots, but he had the big pick, which, you know, it fell kind of right to him, but you only get what you know presents itself to you. And
he did plenty with it afterward too.
Yeah, really nice return. I thought the best player in the entire game for SU, obviously Dungy got the MVP award, and no one's going to complain about that. I thought Kendall Coleman was the best player on the field. He had the 3 sacks. He was so disruptive, especially in missing Alton Robinson. That was a little bit of a concern, but we got plenty of pressure on them all game. Tyrell Richards had a sack. Ryan Guthrie had a sack. And then I think we just had the 5. But Coleman, I think all 3 of his tackles in the games were sacks. And he had a couple other hurries, so he was just really disruptive, and I believe he has another year as well.
Yeah, he has another year. I think that gives him, I think he's got 10 or 11 sacks in the year now, so we ended up with 2 double-digit sack guys this season.
Yeah, and then a handful of, I mean, like Kenny Ruff had a handful. We had like 2 or 3 other guys with like in like the 4 to 6 range, which is really impressive that you have that much, you have that many guys who can be disruptive and that the defense has to worry about versus just having like the one guy like Alton who gets most of the headlines coming off the edge. It's way harder to deal with. And that's what we looked for this year. We looked for interceptions coming into the year. We looked for sacks, disruptive plays that could end drives early, even if we don't have the best coverage units. And it really paid off this season. I thought the defense kind of transformed into what we were looking for out of the defense that we were pairing with this offense. And when you have guys like Andre Sisto, who was an All-American, Joffrey, who had a huge turnaround this year, even, you know, then the Kylan Whitner, who I thought played a lot better this season, and then the defensive line, I thought was just lights out for most of the year, even though we really didn't know what to expect from most of them. Just a really impressive development during the season.
Yeah, I think, you know, the offense is going to get the headlines, but it's really this defense and the way they played, the bend and don't break style. I mean, West Virginia, not to take away from them, I know we said SU definitely clearly won, but, you know, West Virginia, if they were able to punch in a couple of those, you know, deep drives, this could have been a much more competitive game late. But defense continued to do its bend but don't break act. They let West Virginia pick up some big gains, but were able to hold their ground for the most part in the red zone, force them to settle for some field goals. And, you know, that's how you get an opportunity deep in the Mountaineers zone, you know, down just 1 point going into the fourth quarter. And, you know, SU kind of quickly took the lead and then suffocated from there. Like, this is the sort of defense that we wanted under Scott Schaefer, and we had for very brief glimpses. We had this when Scott Schaefer was the defensive coordinator. But this is just such a more athletic group. This is such a more game-changing group than what we'd had in those previous seasons. I mean, I think I saw SU tweeted this was the most sacks we've ever had in a season with 43.
I missed that tweet, but I mean, I'd be a little surprised that like the Dwight Freeney team wouldn't have been up there since he had like almost, I think he had like high teens in 2001, but maybe I don't know much about the rest of that defensive line. But yeah, all year we were very good at getting to the quarterback, which was not a strength last season or the year before.
Or the year before that. No, we actually, yeah, I think we had more sacks this year. I looked at the tweet. Tweet is, yeah, in 85 they had 41 in one season. This was 43. So this is the new record. But yeah, we had more sacks this season than we did in the last 2 seasons combined.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive, and I believe it because it just became so much a part of the defense. And I'm going to say Brian Ward probably going to be back next year.
Yeah, I think the fire Ward train has to derail at some point.
I almost hope it continues. Like, I hope we get the Fire Ward things like well into that season, just as it made me laugh all year. Even like when it was obvious, most of the time it was like an obvious joke by the end of the year. But I always appreciate the memes.
Well, admittedly, the memes became a great part of this season. I think that, admittedly, after game one, I was very concerned about Brian Ward's job security.
Oh yeah, there were legitimate questions. Like, we're not, people weren't being ridiculous.
Yeah, game one, I even said, like, I don't know, like, should we fire Ward? Like, I was definitely not convinced anymore that, like, Ward was the solution. But you know what, like...
That happens when Tim Buster, like, just goes to town on you. Like, somehow. That'll raise some questions.
Yeah, Tim Lester, you know, did everything with his offense at Western Michigan that you wanted him to do with his offense at Syracuse. But then after that, like you said, SU's defense kind of figured it out. And I think... I'm very encouraged for next year because of that. But I guess moving on from football for now, at least, the basketball team. We've won two straight games beating no one of any real particular acclaim. But I still think that, like, you know what, teams like this need those confidence boosting wins, and like, no, they're not a young team by any means. They're not a team that, like, needs to get a few under their belt. But I feel like they are a momentum team, and, you know, scoring 80 plus in two straight games should hopefully get them a little more, you know, back on track. And I think seeing better play from players like Pascal Chukwu, you know, he had 13 rebounds in that Arkansas State game, only had 6 in the St. Bonnie's game, but nonetheless, like, getting a little bit more on track, you know, Frank Howard getting a little bit more involved offensively, Tyus Battle finding a stroke more, like, again, Arkansas State and St. Bonaventure are nothing to, like, you know, write home about. But after two embarrassing games against Old Dominion and Buffalo, I think it's good to get those bounce back contests going into the Notre Dame game against a Notre Dame team that definitely pesky at home, but also reeling after losing to, I believe it was, Coppin State the other day.
Yeah, I feel pretty good about things. Like, obviously, Arkansas State and St. Bonaventure, but Bonnies have played us really tough the last couple years. I don't think this is a very good Bonnie team. They're 4-9, but after those two, the Buffalo State and the ODU games, two teams that I do think, and Buffalo's definitely good, ODU I think is probably like a pretty decent mid-major.
Yeah.
But the Bonnies have played us so tough the last couple of years. I think that feels pretty good either way. Arkansas State is not a bad team, and we looked really sluggish in the first half, which wasn't a little disconcerting, but we played maybe our best half of basketball in the second against them, winning, I think, 44-16 in that half. And then the Bonnies, we just steamrolled the whole game. So it was nice to see us put together back-to-back performances like that, because we really, like, even against these, like, lesser teams that we've beaten earlier in the year, it hasn't looked great all the time. Cornell was, like, kind of a grind. Colgate was kind of a grind for a bit. Like, this team hasn't been great about just putting teams away, and it was nice to see over that second half against Arkansas State and then the whole Bonnies game, just see them kind of assert their dominance. Battle, I thought, was awesome against the Bonnies. I think he was a perfect 8-for-8 from the field. We're seeing more out of Hughes. O'Shea was quiet in the last game, but was better in Arkansas State. I'm really interested. I feel like it hasn't been like an obvious, like, it hasn't been like the thing that fixed it, but it is interesting that this has kind of come about since we made the change to put Doley as a starting center, even if he's like, you know, even if it was Chukwu who had the bigger impact in that first game, or and Doljai, he had a nice game against the Bonnies, but wasn't like, you know, one of like those storing mid-teens points outings like he had late last year. But it does seem like, you know, maybe that has made some kind of a difference, even if it isn't quite obvious yet. But we were all like wondering if something like that could happen, even after Boeheim kind of made fun of the notion.
Yeah, it does seem like typical Boeheim, unfortunately, and or fortunately, I guess, depending on your state of mind, where he mocks an idea and then proceeds to embrace it and to some great result. And again, opponent adjusted here. SU, the numbers don't look great just from a, you know, computer standpoint. 9-4 isn't great, obviously. But at the same time, like, KenPom says they're still a top 30 team. A lot of people are pretty high on this team's resume right now, which, again, you know, props to Kip Wellman for putting together yet another schedule that's going to help us out. No, you don't want to lose to Buffalo. You do need to pick up the pace on some of those, you know, tier one, tier two wins. But nonetheless, I think if we can go 10-8 in ACC play, I feel pretty good. especially if some of those 10 wins are against the top half and the top, you know, quarter of this league. So I'm excited about it. I think that, you know, we haven't turned a corner yet, but I think we're starting to round into some sort of form. We do have three players who can score, you know, 14, 15 points a game. I think it's similar to last year. It'd be nice if you know, Frank Howard joined that group, or if Dolezal could even get closer to like 9 to 10 points a game. But I have some faith we'll get there. I know we might not have to worry about scoring as much against Notre Dame. I did mistakenly say they lost to Coppin State earlier. They did not lose to Coppin State. They almost did, but ended up pulling out the win. Notre Dame is not necessarily the force to be reckoned with that some people thought they could have been earlier this season. Obviously, they already lost to Radford, so take that for what it's worth. But, you know, without Rex Pfluger, they are they're definitely not as good. TJ Gibbs is still going to be, you know, a pretty quality player. Juwan Durham, among some others, still make Notre Dame, you know, a peskier opponent. But I definitely feel a little bit better about this game than I did even a week ago, based on, you know, SU's improvement and also seeing Notre Dame kind of start to play down a little bit to their opponents.
Yeah, the Notre Dame start to the season is actually like kind of reminds me of ours. Like they struggled top of the state. They didn't look great against Binghamton, but they beat like Purdue. So it's been kind of a weird one for them. It's obviously very hard to play them at the Joy Center, but they're definitely pretty beatable. And it would be a nice way to you know, off to a decent start in ACC play. Yeah, so we'll see how that goes. That's on the 5th, right? That's
yeah. So we get a little bit of it's a Saturday.
Oh, it's that Saturday. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, I think that's a good break. Sometimes I don't mind the closer games together because I feel like it keeps momentum going. But in this case, I think that, you know, we've only played like two games since the 22nd. I think it's fine to take a little bit of a breather and kind of recollect after what was a pretty rough stretch in there.
Yeah, especially because, like, obviously Frank Howard is still a work in progress. Like, I don't mind having him get more time off away from the court to continue to get closer to the player that we know he can be, which he hasn't really shown yet. So I think that's still a thing to watch for.
Yeah, I am pretty bummed about Frank. We've talked about this too. Like, you know, after James's feature and some of the other things you read all off season, like, it did seem like he was going to be a real impactful offensive player. His shot was improved, and then, you know, having a leg injury can really hurt explosiveness and everything else, and that's kind of where we're at with him now, where I feel like we're just I don't know when we're going to be able to turn this corner, and that's not his fault. Obviously it's not his fault he got injured by any means, but I think that we still might be another few weeks away from him really being able to get himself right physically and also, you know, mentally with that.
Yeah, hopefully this time off will help, and hopefully that, you know, by the grind of, you know, mid ACC season when we're playing those crazy turnarounds, he'll be good to go. Otherwise, this could get ugly. But I think, you know, all things considered, considering we've lost some weird games, three of the four losses, actually all four. Oregon doesn't look great right now. None of the four losses look great. Buffalo is probably the best one, to be honest. And hopefully the Bulls win like 30 games this year. I think it's about as good a spot as you can be in, considering you're 9-4 with one ranked win. The metrics, like the net rating, I think we're like 60th, which like doesn't sound great, but it feels like it could be a lot worse. I think we're gonna get a lot of benefit of the doubt if we turn around and win 10 or 11 ACC games. I think we'll be pretty solid.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think 10. I mean, 10 or 11, you're in. I think the right 9, you're in. But again, that also means like the right 9, but then like just losing the toss-up games and not losing any of like the bad games. So we'll get further into the ACC schedule in the coming weeks, both literally on the court and also on the podcast. But some halftime here before we continue our journey through a little bit of annual recap stuff. So Dan, what were you drinking over this this lengthy holiday break?
I've actually had a decent amount over the last couple weeks. Let me find starting point here. I had The Calling from Boulevard. Not usually I end up with the I don't think I brought that up last week. Usually I end up with the what's it, Tank 7, their Saison, which is fantastic. Calling was quite nice as well. And their stuff's always pretty good. I had a Fata Morgana by Omnipolo. I went to Blind Tiger in New York, which is one of the better beer bars, so I was able to
love Blind Tiger.
A number of different things. This is a Swedish brewery, Omnipolo. Had not had anything from them before. The Fata Morgana was really, really good. I had from Evil Twin here in New York. I had a If You Want the Rainbow, You've Got to Put Up with the Rain, a very classic long Evil Twin title. Really nice IPA from them. And they have so much stuff out now around here since they opened their brewery and their brew pub. From Finback, I had an Ultramarine. I believe it's a double IPA. Finback does a really nice job with like those juicy East Coast IPAs. I had a Super Session IPA number 2 from Lost and Sinus Liquids up in Vermont. They always do an awesome job as well. And then right now, I'm not at this moment, but in my fridge, I've had a couple of the Samoa This from Southern Tier upstate. I've had a couple different like Samoa beers, like the chocolatey, coconutty stouts and porters. This one's a stout. It's really, really good. Super drinkable. It's sweet, but not too sweet. And definitely like hits a nice blend of like the idea of getting that kind of Samoa, I think the Girl Scout cookie flavors without like pounding you over the head with them. And for a stout, it's like super, super drinkable. So really enjoy that one. It's also 10% and kind of a dangerous, boozy one.
Yeah, I fall victim to some of those here and there. Couple from me, and by couple I mean several. I had from St. Arnold down in Houston, Divine Reserve number 16, their old ale. I finally opened this one up from the brewery. It's their Brewer's Barrel Age Zesty Mounds. It's a coconut imperial stout with a orange zest that I was very doubtful of it, and it actually worked out pretty well. The brewery does like an annual kind of like Black Tuesday treatment contest where they have Reserve Society members and Hoarders members, you know, bring different treatment options to, you know, kind of alter the beer a little bit. And then the winner gets bottled. So this one was the one that won, I think, it was 2016, but I didn't open it until this year. And again, was very skeptical. The flavors would hold up, and they definitely did. Swung over to Smog City while my parents were in town. Had Animal House, their latest pale ale. Smog doesn't bottle any of their pale ales, but they've tested out a few different ones on draft lately. And yeah, this one in particular really impressed me. Also had from Smog, Rabbit Eyes. It was a Saison aged in gin barrels. Actually had two gin barrel aged beers in the last couple weeks. And if it's a thing that's going to start catching on, it was very good. What else did I have? I'm just cruising through. All right, Black Kisses from Monkish. Just another bottle of theirs that I had around. My buddy had brought over from Latitude 33 Brewing, Brokini. Was a toasted coconut hazy IPA. He also brought over from Revolution Brewing in Chicago, Mineshaft Gap. It was a cognac barrel-aged barley wine. Now, this was a very cognac-heavy beer, in a great way. It was actually one of my favorite beers of the year that I had anyway. Good one to check out if you're ever in the Chicago area. I've been drinking a bunch of Stone Tropic of Thunder Lager of late. It's an easy drink. And then on the gin barrel-aged front, I had a Hill Farmstead got out here with their Brother Saunier Saison. So, yeah, that was my last week and a half, 2 weeks in drinking.
Awesome. Sorry, I was muted.
Totally fine. We're keeping that in. Because Lewis isn't around this week.
Lewis is in Florida. Shout out to Lewis. Yeah, we're not gonna make him. We're not gonna make him edit from vacation.
Definitely not. All right. So, with the last time we have here, figure jump into some of the most commented posts of 2018 on the blog. Like I said to Dan beforehand, some of these are expected. Some of these were not. So starting with number one, Darius Bazley opts for G League and won't play for Syracuse, per report. That got 375 comments. People were not pleased, and it turned into yelling at each other, because that's kind of what happens in college sports.
Yeah, this was like a perfect, I think a perfect blend of like all, a ton of touchy issues. Like, the just it happened to us, and that's a very Syracuse thing to happen. It was our number one recruit. It was, you know, came with very high expectations for the season. It's a decision that, you know, makes some sense, but not like, you know, it's not an obvious thing. It's not like he's going to make millions. Or like, if he had gone to opt to play overseas, I think it would have been handled a little, or it would have been taken maybe a little bit more easily. But either way, I think we're all pretty over it now. Now that the season started, even if basically would have helped. But yeah, very fun for this to happen to us.
It is a very Syracuse thing. The second most read article was, to no surprise, Sean's latest apology letter to America from Syracuse basketball. This has become a tradition every time we, as a lesser seed, manage to get to the Sweet 16. Hopefully we're not in this situation again this year. Hopefully we just end up with a seed that that's indicative of winning a couple games. But yeah, as always, Sean seems to strike the balance between appealing to Syracuse fans and appealing to like the greater college basketball media that just seems to get what Sean's saying and not take it too personally. The Buffalo game pissed off a lot of people, and yeah, it somehow ended up being number three on this. So two out of the first three negative, but the rest of these are actually pretty positive.
It is a little sad that the Buffalo game jumped Michigan State. Like, Michigan State came in for four.
Well, people were... The problem with the Buffalo game is that people were enraged, and it started to get into the, like, Jim doesn't have it anymore tropes. And, like, as soon as you get into those, then, like, then, you know, people just kind of... You have the rational defenders of Jim, and you have the irrational defenders of Jim that just start showing up. You also have the irrational Jim haters. That'll come out of the woodworks. There's a lot going on there.
It's funny. I think you can criticize Jim Boeheim without saying that he definitely has lost it based on two losses. Or, and I think you can also, you know, maybe defend Jim Boeheim without pretending like he is completely infallible. It's weird, but I think those are both true.
I would agree. Number four was Syracuse stunned Michigan State. That was awesome. I had a lot of fun watching that game, even if I had my heart in my throat for the last like 5 to 7 minutes of it. Braden Bayer, it should be a legend at SU, even if I feel like half of SU fans have already like kind of moved on from that. But yeah, he's a guy who should live on in some sort of you know, folklore or oral history that we write up 10 years from now about that game.
I'm going to interject quick with something that has nothing to do with this, but I think you'll appreciate it. Steve Sarkisian and the rest of the Falcons, I think both Falcons coordinators got fired. Where does Steve Sarkisian serve as offensive coordinator in college next year?
Somewhere in the SEC.
It's very possible.
USC's off the table.
Oh god, that'd be so funny.
Yeah, USC's already off the table because Cliff Kingsbury ended up in the perfect place for him.
Turning down Houston, apparently.
Which, actually, would Houston hire Sark?
As their head coach?
That'd be so dumb.
That'd be so dumb.
They would do it. I mean, the perfect marriage would be send Holgo to Houston, Sark goes to West Virginia.
Oh my god.
Actually, no, that's like...
Being, that's a terrible marriage. Yeah, that no,
I know.
That's so culturally not...
Being fully serious, like, alcoholism's a real thing, and I don't want to see that happen to Sark, because that would be, like, just a really shitty, like, situation for him to be in as a person.
The whole Holgerson leaving for Houston thing seems to have legs, and I'm worried about how West Virginia fans are going to handle that. Because, like, it seems like they're kind of over him, but you also don't want to lose your coach to a group of five, even if it's a group of five with, like, a really, really high ceiling.
Well, I already said the reason that he's leaving is because he doesn't want to lose the Syracuse in bowl games anymore.
Yeah, and we're probably not going to play Houston in very many bowl games. So it makes sense.
Unless Houston gets themselves to an access bowl next year. Then we'll see you guys there.
What does West Virginia do if they lose him?
Nothing, because they don't have like a, like they're screwed because, like, I mean, we've been victim to this timing before. That, like, what if you lose a guy like around New Year's, you don't have any recourse. I mean, granted, the early signing period helps in this case, but you don't really have a lot of recourse when it comes to like fixing the situation. All of the viable candidates are gone. The rising coordinators are like, yeah, I wouldn't even know. Like, they'd probably, and to be honest, I think they'd probably end up hiring Neil Brown.
That'd be a great hire, I think. It's something's going on with Neil Brown. He maybe just doesn't interview well or something, or he's, I don't know, his personality at all. He should be a head coach at a Power 5. So if they, like, fell in Neil Brown, they could be doing a lot worse. The whole situation's just weird, though.
Yeah, and, like, Neil
Brown... Or Steph Luttrell, I could see, too.
Luttrell would be good, but, like, Neil Brown's from Kentucky. He's right nearby.
Yeah.
But, like, he doesn't... I think the problem with that people have with Brown is that, like, they don't necessarily know what he can do from, like, a staff and, like, recruiting standpoint. Like, he's a very good coach. He is still fairly young. He's 38. You know, he played at Kentucky and UMass. He's from Kentucky. Most of his experience has been at Troy. His time as Kentucky offensive coordinator wasn't, like, amazing. He doesn't necessarily, like, other than Troy, he doesn't necessarily have, like, a huge track record. I'm fine with it. And, like, I think the Brown is going to be very successful, but I could see how, like, you know, programs that are focused on the wrong things could get a little too worked up over a couple of those factors.
Yeah, also Louisville apparently not wanting him because he went to Kentucky once, even though he didn't graduate from there.
Yeah.
And their AD's from Kentucky. But anyway.
If I were them, I would think that the fact that he left Kentucky would be a positive.
Yeah.
He hated Kentucky so much that he went to UMass.
Whole thing's hilarious.
Damn. Number five, we're not going to talk about this one. Greek life is part of Syracuse's larger cultural problem.
It'll come up at some point again. We'll have to talk about it, so we'll save it for them.
Yeah, I'll just repost that article. This is actually one of my favorite articles I've ever written here, even though it's not about Syracuse sports. But a lot of people were annoyed by that one. A lot of people liked it too, though. Number six, NCAA tournament, Syracuse 60, Arizona State 56. That was a great game. Arizona State was a very good offense, and we smothered them into oblivion. That was kind of when I started thinking ahead a couple rounds back in March, because I did feel like, okay, if they can do this to ASU, and ASU seemed like a bad matchup for us, I was very curious about what could happen next.
Yeah, it really set the stage for that run. ASU was averaging, I think, over 80 points a game. They had been scoring pretty well all season, even when they, like, you know, lost to some good teams. They had spent a little bit of time at number one, I think, earlier in the year. Obviously, they weren't a number one team, as, you know, they fell into a play-in game. But the fact that we held them to 56 points, really impressive, and kind of set the stage for what we did the next couple rounds, and even into that Duke game.
Agreed. Number seven, Syracuse football finally returns to the top 25. This was the rare, like, non-game related, well, sort of non-game related, non, like, news related item on here. It was a Sunday afternoon. Everyone was super excited about the NC State game. And then we find out we're back in the top 25 for the first time in 17 years. Everybody was pretty psyched. Ends up that it was not a short-term thing and ended up being a very long-term thing. And could end up extending into next season for all we know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we're a pretty good bet to start the, once, like, the pre-usual round, people are like, oh, yeah, Tommy DeVito's a thing and we're returning so many players. Like, we're probably going to start the year in the 15-20 range.
It's fine to me.
If I had to guess, which is awesome.
Yeah, I didn't think we'd live in this reality. Thank you, Dino Babers. Number eight, Syracuse beats Western Michigan, but leaves more questions than answers. We talked about this earlier. Tangentially about how weird that first game was. I had some questions, and I think a lot of us did had some questions for why Dungy was pulled so early. You know, I think Dino is a much more, like, malleable guy than a lot of people might give him credit for as a coach. I think, like, he's adapted his system to Syracuse, and he's adapted some things to Syracuse personnel. I think the system itself wasn't really meant for a guy like Dungy, and he figured out a way to make it work. I think he also figured out that if you have a short leash on Dungy, it's only going to hurt what you're going to get out of him. So I think that this was a, I think this was something that Dino learned from and everybody else in the program learned from too.
Yeah, I think one of his great strengths is that Dino does not seem married to anything in terms of like what he's doing. Obviously, he has an offensive system. It works really well, but he's not married to only running it one way or only doing things a certain way. He has shown really good adaptability since coming to Syracuse and even taking the Syracuse job when he had no connections up here. It was not like, you know, it was not discussed as like this great job. He's just really done an awesome job of kind of going, rolling with the punches, staying even keeled, never getting too worked up or anything. And his handling of the quarterback situation, I think, was pretty indicative of that all year. And even right up to the bowl game where he said, like, he revealed with that Chris Carson interview that he, you know, it was a really close race all season. And that should make us all excited, because if DeVito was legitimately that close, and I don't think Babers would have said it if it wasn't the case, considering, you know, Dungy's status as our senior quarterback and, like, one of our greatest players of the last couple decades, that's got to be exciting for most of us going forward.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you. I think that the fact that he was able to, the fact that Dungy needed to pretty much like fight off DeVito as the starter all year. I mean, take the Notre Dame game out of the equation, but like DeVito did look impressive in his, you know, time on the field other than that game, and I think it does bode really well, especially again given the contributors around him that we mentioned earlier.
And they both handled it well, considering. Like, not to cast aspersions at all with like the Justin Fields situation or a lot of these other quarterbacks transferring, but I think with less of a deft touch, like DeVito's a guy who could go start at most programs, or and obviously he knows it's his job next year. But you know, you could have seen him getting fed up, especially in some of the games that Dungy hasn't played well. But I think Babers really just kind of rode the situation about as gracefully as you could, because it could have turned ugly, and it really didn't. At all.
Yeah, I know there were like the rumors of like them not being like super tight at one point. I feel like it's funny now to look back at those and go like, I don't really understand how that's even possible, because you see them on the field, you see them on the sidelines, like the two of them seem extremely close at this point. And like, you know, I think it looks, Dino said it enough times, I think DeVito and Dungy mentioned it enough times, it's far from acting. There's no way that at this point, like there's any acting going on. Like they're actually friends. And I think that DeVito has learned a lot from Dungy. I think that's going to benefit him next year.
Yeah. I think most of us probably heard those rumors at some point, and like, there might've been something there that would be like a pretty natural thing. But like you said, I think if that was the case at some point, I think it went away, and Babers' handling of both of them and being transparent and keeping the competition open, I think, probably brought out the best in both of them and made it so that they could support each other when they were given their opportunities.
Agreed. Number nine. Let's hope Syracuse football didn't just miss its opportunity. Spoiler: it did not. this was after the Pitt game, where SU looked a little out of sorts in that game. Obviously,
how weird is it that we lost two games in a row this year?
It is, considering we only lost three total, which in and of itself is an odd thing to say. But this was an article written, and admittedly in other years would have been a harbinger of things to come, and I thought it might have been here.
We had seen this play out, and obviously in some of those other years, like, it's felt like more like we were exposed as like a team that wasn't actually that good. This was two really like tough losses in a row,
right?
But still, like, we all heard like the footsteps, and luckily the footsteps ended up like not really being an actual entity.
Was glad to see that. And then number 10, Syracuse fans shouldn't worry about losing Dino Babers this year. They should be terrified about next year. This was another winner from Sean, who accurately kind of spelled out how this offseason's coaching search was going to go. I think the extension for Dino is great. I think, you know, we're not going to know what that number is for a while. We might not even know that number until after he's potentially gone. But I hope Dino's around for a while. I think that, you know, the more success that he brings here, it's only going to make those calls louder. I think, you know, everyone should have their eye on the USC job and really be rooting for USC to win at least 8 games this coming season. Because if it's not USC, like, there's not another clear, there really isn't another clear gig out there.
Auburn's the other one that concerns me.
See, I think Dino's smart enough to realize that there is no winning at Auburn.
Yeah, the problem is Auburn is that school that will pay whatever they need to pay if they think he's the guy.
Right.
They have very, very deep pockets, and we obviously don't know the specifics of Dino's contract, but I think we can assume it's you know, let's say between $3.5-4 million a year ish, like on the low end even.
Right.
If it's even that, like Auburn can pay a coach $6-7 million a year, and that's just tough to compete with. And if he really wants a like national title shot, like Auburn was almost died in the playoff with two losses last year, so that's a tough situation. But on the other hand, like you said, if you look at Auburn and how they've handled Gus Malzahn, where they were apparently asking him to like get rid of contract clauses and buyouts, like, no, that's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous way to handle a coaching situation. So you hope that that's like something where he looks at that and says like, it's a great job, I don't want to deal with that. Right. Or
it could be a legend in Central New York.
Yeah. And then beyond those, like, there aren't other top jobs. Like, Ohio State, I think Ryan Day's going to do a good job there. And obviously, even if he doesn't, I think he's going to get at least a couple of years. Florida State should be concerning, maybe, yeah, with Taggart. He's not a Florida guy, which doesn't really matter all the time, but I think there'll be some hangups there.
I think if Taggart doesn't make a bowl game next year, he's gone.
I think Taggart was probably pretty close to being gone this year.
I wouldn't doubt that.
Most 1 year coaches, which is ridiculous. But and I think Taggart, there's a very good chance he turns that around. But yeah, they there aren't that many bona fide powerhouse jobs that open up at ever. Like there just aren't that many in general. But probably those are probably the three that jump out as things that could come open, short of like the whole like Saban retires and Dabo takes over Alabama thing that people think will happen eventually. But I don't see Saban retiring in the next 2 years.
No, I agree with you. Well, cool. I think that there are plenty of other articles you can mention. For those who missed these year in review posts, I had this one. There was one about my favorite articles from the staff. Another one about my favorite articles that I wrote that you can care or not care about. I mean, if you want to read it, great, because I took some time to do it. But other than that, I think that it was a fun year. We said we had two really big highs along with a bunch of other medium highs. But fun season overall. I mean, I know this encompasses two different academic years, but another fun year of Syracuse athletics. I know, Dan, you've been the longest tenured person around here. Now that Sean is not a full-time participator, anything, any lasting things that you want to say here at the end of Noon's Magician year number 12?
No, I think this was a really cool year. I think and I'm like, you know, I do the podcast and I'm in Slack and like, but otherwise I'm like kind of looking in from half the outside. Like I'm involved, but I'm not making like on the ground decisions, but I think we've really kind of rounded into form in terms of like people covering the individual teams, and people have kind of fallen into like really comfortable spots in terms of covering the teams in a unique way. I think it's awesome that the community has stayed very strong and even grown. We see that with the Cheese Tits for Kids again this year, which obviously I don't think anyone expected to like eclipse the Texas Bowl thing, because that was just such a spur of the moment thing and such a unique situation. But if it's a thing where we're donating, if we could raise, you know, 15, 20 grand every time we go to a bowl game and get some kids there, I think that's an amazing thing that's looks like it's becoming a tradition, and hopefully it's a tradition in that our football team goes to bowls all the time. It's just been really cool to stay involved for me since like 2010, and just see the community continue to thrive and the site have a really, really great year.
Thank you for your contributions, as always, Dan. They are always, yes, always appreciated.
Yes, I'm thrilled to be hanging around and interacting with people on Twitter and helping out with the jokes and the garbage.
And I want to thank everybody else, too, for listening, for reading, for all that. I know I mentioned it on Twitter in several different ways today, the 31st, for those listening. But did want to thank everybody for listening. I think, you know, thanks again to Lewis for really really helping elevate what we do here and on the podcast and making this a lot more listenable. Dan and I have had a lot of fun with this over the years, and I think that the one thing that was missing was kind of that slight production quality uptick to help bring you into the jokes and garbage as much and have as much fun with it as we do. I think that's, I mean, at least according to the listener numbers, it's been working. So we'll keep doing what we're doing here, and I hope to hope to get a lot more feedback from everybody too. Like, you know, feel free to tell us what you want more of, what you want less of, though we might not listen to the less part. We'll see.
Yes, there will be no fewer. If anything, we're gonna double down on Tulane. I think we our Syracuse football team's rolling. We don't need to fetch about the team. So Tulane, we're on you. 2019, Willie Fritz, onward and upward.
I know Fear the Wave actually like went to the Camping World Bowl.
Wait, really?
That's yeah, amazing. Went to the Camping World Bowl, and they sent me a picture from, like, they were hanging around for the post game and everything. Like, they sent me a picture from it, and they said they want to return the favor for like fan tourism with the others program. So
it's a real shame that their bowl was like so far ahead of ours, because if it was like a day or two, I think we could have had a nice, like, let's get as many Syracuse fans to go to that bowl. You could get in for like $3. And hopefully we find ourselves in a similar situation where we're playing like a couple days apart and can go and support Tulane weirdly and have no one understand what's happening.
Yeah, that's the goal for next year. Get Tulane to the same city within a reasonable couple days.
Yeah, if we're like, all right, so we'll be in like the Cotton Bowl, and we'll say Tulane can be in like the Heart of Dallas or whatever that's called now. I think that's the
First Responders Bowl.
First Responders, Support the Troops, Armed Forces.
Cancellation Bowl.
America Bowl. That was the one that got canceled. That really sucks. I feel so bad for those fans.
I feel bad for them.
People are like, oh, who cares? It's Boston College, Boise. I'm like, yeah. And I know there probably weren't that many fans there, but the ones who were there flew a long way.
Right. Boston flew a very long way.
Upwards of $1,000 to go make a weekend of this to see their teams. And, like, that's just like garbage. You had to find a way to play that game. So,
on the bright side, yeah, Steve Adazio didn't go 7-6 this year.
No, he did not.
He went 7-5.
I can't wait for them to go 6-6 next year and for them to fire Adazio and have BC fans being like, we have to hire Babers.
Enjoy. I'm sure you guys will get around.
See at least one guy be like, we're gonna go poach Babers. That's a thing Boston College can definitely do.
That's a thing that Boston College fans are definitely gonna try to do. It's not gonna happen, but anyway. This was fun as always, Dan.
Yes.
Anyway.
Hope you enjoy your New Year's Eve.
You as well. And to everybody listening out there, I hope you enjoyed past tense.
Yes, hope everyone makes it.
Yeah, hope everyone enjoys. Hope everyone is safe. And happy New Year to all. That was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, wherever else you listen to this podcast. And go Orange.
Go Orange.